This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. On Wednesday, the CDC released a troubling statistic. In 2020, more than 93,000 people in the U.S. died from drug overdoses. 93,000. That's a nearly 30% increase from the previous year. That's the biggest increase in around five decades, according to Politico. Experts say that the isolation and depression that so many experienced during the pandemic likely played a significant role in the spike in overdose deaths. We reached out to our listeners about this, and here's how the overdose crisis has affected some of you.
My name is Kay, and I live in Petaluma. I'm a school teacher, and I lost one student overdosed about 3 weeks after lockdown. And then a second one 2 weeks later. The second one survived, but the first did not. And we were all just shattered and are still shattered.
I'm Ursula, calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I have been affected by the overdose crisis. I'm 26. I have lost count of how many friends I've lost to overdose. At least one friend a year overdoses and dies. And it never gets any easier. Knowing my friends have died preventable deaths is so maddening. I carry Narcan with me everywhere I go, and I hope that I never have to use it.
Hi, my name is Marceline Brown. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. My beautiful 27-year-old son, Jack, died on December 12th, 2020 from an accidental overdose that contained fentanyl. Earlier in the evening of the night he died, he came over to my house to get his birth certificate. He was very excited. He was going to start a new job. He wasn't high when he came by. He looked healthy and happy. He gave me a big hug like he always does and said, "I love you, Mom." I hugged him back as he was leaving and said, "I love you too. Be careful." And he said, "Will do," and gave me that beautiful smile I will never forget. The next morning, the police knocked on my door. Apparently, the horrific sound and scream of the grief escaping my body was heard through the neighborhood, and I don't know because I don't remember. The grief will extend generations. 2 months after his death and 24 hours before what would have been his 28th birthday, his daughter was born. He never got to see her or hold her. She will never meet her father. My life is forever changed, and I don't know how to reconcile all of this unnecessary trauma and grief.
We are so grateful to you for sharing with us. And please know, the Takeaway family considers each of your stories to be special and each of your losses to be meaningful. Earlier this week, President Joe Biden nominated Dr. Rahul Gupta to lead the Office of National Drug Council Policy, which would make him the country's top official dealing with the opioid epidemic. Dr. Gupta has experience working on the opioid crisis in West Virginia. However, some public health advocates have been critical of him for not doing more to prevent the closure of a syringe exchange program in Charleston, West Virginia, during his time as the state's public health commissioner. If Dr. Gupta is confirmed, he'll be one of many public health officials faced with the urgent task of figuring out how to reduce drug overdoses. Understanding the overdose crisis we're in and whether there are any clear solutions is where we start today. With me now is Usha Lee McFarling, National Science Correspondent for STAT. Usha, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Linda Sacco, Chief Clinical Officer of Phoenix House, which is a nonprofit drug rehabilitation organization operating in 10 states. Linda, great to have you here as well.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So Usha, as we heard in that heartbreaking story from Marceline from Salt Lake City, it feels as though this grief and loss is so unnecessary. Can you talk to me about what harm reduction is?
Well, harm reduction is trying to get opioid preventive drugs to people, trying to get substance abuse treatment to people, meeting them where they are. These programs occur in cities across the U.S. and they're critical. And these are things that were almost completely shut down as the rest of the country was when the pandemic started last March.
So take us into that moment just a bit more to the start of the pandemic. What did most harm reduction programs do when those lockdowns began around the country?
Well, I think people were stunned in all sectors of the country. And, you know, some very valiantly tried to persist and go on and meet people. I spoke with workers from Prevention Point in Philadelphia that work in some of the hardest hit areas of that city. You know, they work out of vans, they work in small storefronts. A lot of those outreach workers got COVID just as they tried to do their work. You know, these programs, they couldn't bring people into residential settings as they had. People were scared. People were on lockdown. So people just were really hard to reach. Seven-step programs like AA and Narcotics Anonymous, those could not meet in person. So a lot of people were just left without any resources.
Now, Linda, what did that mean for patients to lose those harm reduction and inpatient and other support programs?
Well, as we like to say, the opposite of addiction is connection, and losing those really, really important connections for people created so much isolation and disruption in life. They couldn't see their families. As Usha said, 12-step programs were closed. MAT programs might have been closed to get their medication. So people really kind of dug in. It made getting into recovery and remaining in recovery really difficult. We know many people who may not have been diagnosed with a substance use or mental health issue before the pandemic have reported increasing their substance use, their drinking, their smoking, as a way to cope with that stress and isolation.
Do the data tell us anything about, because I think there are, you know, there were different kinds of experiences of isolation. For some folks, it was literally being isolated from everyone, home alone for days and weeks and months on end. For other folks, it meant being isolated, but isolated with, for example, children or spouses or parents. I'm wondering if data tell us anything at this point about what kinds of social isolation might have been most related, Linda, to these overdoses.
It's really all kinds of isolation that when you disrupt somebody's life, what they're used to, it can really exacerbate any symptoms or any problems that were there before. So folks that might have been struggling, maybe they were just getting by, they had a job, their children were in school, suddenly they're working from home, the children are home, money becomes very tight, people in the family were dying. So it was just all of those things sort of swirling around together that just threw everybody really off. They're normal.
Now, Usha, obviously there were a wide variety of you know, sort of areas of the, and sectors of the economy that were able to pivot to online. But is that something that was possible for substance abuse treatment programs?
It was, and I would say there was some really heroic efforts to get virtual visits for people, to get people back into inpatient care that they needed through testing. There was a lot of creativity. There were also some really progressive changes made to previously when people wanted methadone or their substance abuse medication, they had to come in daily. You know, some rural patients could drive an hour or more. Can you imagine going daily for your doctor for your diabetes or cholesterol medicine? So during the pandemic, they allowed people to get longer, you know, prescriptions for weeks instead of daily. Some of these virtual visits really helped.
Stop right there for just 1 second and help me to understand why. When you make that point about your diabetes medication or something else, why is it that patients who needed methadone were required to come every day?
Well, Linda might want to comment, but, you know, it's considered a drug and there is a risk of abuse or sharing the drug with someone else. But I think studies have shown that those risks are very low and they're certainly much lower than the risk of overdose if you don't have access to your medicine. And if there's an interruption in getting that medicine, you can feel very sick. You can go into withdrawal and then you can turn back to the drug that you're trying to avoid. So there's a lot more risk to not giving people a steady supply of their medication. And during the pandemic, a lot of the steady supply was not there.
Linda, I'm wondering if part of what I'm hearing from Usha, and again, I'm just trying to piece these pieces together, was this, you know, certainly there's a burden on patients who have to arrive every day, but I'm wondering if there's also a burden on the system for that kind of daily medication process. Was the system prior to the start of the pandemic already overburdened?
The system was definitely overburdened. There was a workforce crisis in behavioral health services long before the pandemic, workforce shortages, underfunded, you know, very difficult. And during that pandemic, so there are folks, as Usher said, that go still for their methadone daily. It took a little bit for clinics to really figure out how to change over and be able to give some, they call it take-home medications to clients, figuring out, you know, where and how they could manage that. There are also regulations for other types of medications. So prior to the pandemic, Usha mentioned buprenorphine earlier. The first visit for buprenorphine had to be in person. So anybody coming at the beginning of the pandemic wanting to start treatment, they couldn't find that. Still in this country, 50% of the counties in the U.S. do not have a doctor or a nurse practitioner that is permitted under federal law to prescribe buprenorphine. They have to go and get extra training. It's called, they get a DEA data waiver. So there's a lot of barriers in front of people to get that medications for addiction treatment. During the pandemic, that all just got harder. It was harder and harder to access for people.
Linda, can you say something about the particular drugs? So I know that for you in this process, you rolled the drug names off the tip of your tongue, but help us to understand if there are particular drugs that people were using and what fentanyl is and sort of its role in all of this.
Sure. Fentanyl is a large contributor to the fact that this has been the largest overdose deaths ever recorded in a 12-month period. It's 50 times more potent than heroin. It takes three times the Narcan to reduce an overdose if there's fentanyl involved. So what's happening, it's been mixed in with other drugs. Many people know fentanyl's deadly. They wouldn't touch it by choice. Maybe they were using some cocaine, some methamphetamine. What's been happening over the last year, fentanyl is being mixed in with things so that the person taking their drug of choice, whether it's cocaine, methamphetamine, something else, even heroin, had fentanyl mixed in with it, and they did not know what they were taking.
So if I went to the store and bought a bottle of wine and there was poison mixed into it, we wouldn't understand, then having an overdose from wine as being, you know, a choice that I was making as a wine drinker.
Exactly. Exactly. It's exactly the same. They just didn't know. People started, they came up with testing kits. So in some states, people were given these testing strips so that if you bought drugs, especially from someone you didn't know, you could test it and find out if there was fentanyl in it and then make your choice to use it or not to use it. And they instructed the clients who took these strips, leave the strip near where you are, because if you have an overdose, they'll at least know that you had fentanyl and know better how to help you. Very scary.
I want to come to you, Usha. When we are talking about people and people overdosing, who are we talking about? Are these younger folks, older folks, Southerners, Northerners? Is there a racial demographic? Who is being most impacted?
It's safe to say that it's everyone. You would have wealthy lawyers, housewives, suburban school kids, people experiencing homelessness. It's people in rural areas and urban areas. I'll also say that these numbers, these deaths, shocking, you know, tragic as they are, I think they come as a surprise to, you know, precisely no one who's following this area. You already had a drug epidemic that was out of control because of fentanyl. And then you add the pandemic ushering isolation, depression, grief, economic hardship. These are all known triggers for substance abuse and overdose. So the combination has just been explosive.
And Usha, in some sectors, areas, the pandemic, for all the horror that it was, also produced some creative policy making that now some folks are kind of trying to keep now that the pandemic is beginning, hopefully, to wind down a bit. I'm wondering if there were changes made during the pandemic to substance abuse treatments that could continue.
Well, yeah, I think so. We talked about patients being able to, you know, grab their take homes, as they call them, so they don't have to come to the clinic every day. I think there's also a loosening to allow more people to prescribe substance abuse medication without going through all those loopholes and the extensive training that was needed before, and a lot of the virtual visits. But I think we have to remember that these are benefits that may not benefit everyone. You know, if you have a good internet connection and, you know, can reach your doctor, that's fine. But we had many people who were trying to, say, go to an AA meeting on Zoom, and they didn't have Wi-Fi, so they're Zooming in from the McDonald's parking lot. I spoke with clinicians who said they had, you know, people that only spoke Spanish that went to all Spanish AA meetings. A lot of these did not translate to Zoom. So, you know, technology and innovation will certainly help, but it's not going to help everyone.
That's so helpful to think about it in those very specific contexts. Linda, what is one of the biggest things that we can do right now that will help to address this increase, at least in the immediate future?
I think we really need to keep plugging away at the stigma that is still attached to seeking treatment for substance use disorder. It really is a disorder like any other medical disorder, and there shouldn't be any shame in having an addiction issue or seeking treatment for it. You know, in-person and virtual services, as we said, are available, and people who need it should seek help now. No one really needs to be alone in this struggle. Treatment works, and it's available. You know, to try to pull that stigma away and treat this, as Usha said, if you had diabetes, you wouldn't feel ashamed to go and get treatment.
And when you talk about the stigma, Linda, I'm wondering not only about sort of the kind of individual stigma or shame that a person may feel to go and get the treatment, but I'm also so interested in your point about the testing strips being available, or this critique right now of the person who will now be in charge at the federal level from West Virginia, not, you know, making sure that one of the syringe exchanges was, remained open. So I wonder about how shame and stigma also impact the policymaking that we do.
They definitely do. I think there's still that feeling sometimes that people who have an addiction, who get into this situation, have done so willingly because they're bad. Because, you know, a lot of reasons for doing this, and we never really think about, this is an illness like any other. We would not refuse a diabetic their insulin because they are eating cake. But yet sometimes substance use disorder treatment is hard to access for people because of stigma, because we still sometimes think of this as a moral failing or a refusal to get better.
So, Usha, I'm interested if one of the, you know, part of the horror of this is, as you pointed out, the ways that it impacts across all these demographic groups. But might that also be precisely the sort of opening or possibility for political change, that if this isn't just about poor folks or white folks or brown folks or rural folks, but it's impacting all these different kinds of families, might we be able to see a coalition come forward to pressure for real public policy change on this?
I mean, I would hope so. As we heard from your listeners, you know, these stories are heartbreaking. They affect all of us and they affect all of our families. And I think the problem with the pandemic was public health officials were strapped and they took their eyes off this. And we can never take our eyes off this. This is another epidemic. No matter what happens going forward, we really have to address it. And all of us can help. I think, as Linda does, everyone should carry a can of Narcan. You never know. It might be your boss, might be your high school principal. You know, it just, you might be able to save a life.
Linda, just to go back to sort of the origins, can you help us understand how it is that people often find themselves addicted to these drugs?
There are many ways. There are sometimes folks who have this in their family. They start using alcohol or a drug and then become addicted. There's a biological connection there. Other times it's a reaction to stress. Somebody just starts drinking, it relieves their stress, so we drink more. When that no longer helps you to feel better about that stress, you might turn to another substance.
If someone finds themselves in a situation of being a parent, a loved one, a friend, what's the first step in that moment?
The first step, I think, is making sure that you're not promoting stigma against this disorder, right? This is nothing that you should be hiding from the rest of your family. Bring it out in the open and look for help immediately.
Linda Sacco is the Chief Clinical Officer for Phoenix House, and Usha Lee McFarling is a national science correspondent for STAT. I'm so grateful to both of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know is struggling with substance abuse, you can call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's National Helpline at 1-800-662-4357. Once again, that's 1-800-662-4357. Last November, a brutal war began in Ethiopia between the Ethiopian government and rebel forces in the Tigray region. Thousands have died in the conflict over the past 8 months. And earlier this week, rebel forces claimed that they'd captured Alamata, the major town in the southern part of Tigray. Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, said he would repel the attacks, even though just 2 weeks ago, the federal government declared a ceasefire. We're joined today by Samuel Getachew, a freelance journalist based in Ethiopia. Samuel, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa. How are you?
Can you talk to us about the veracity of the claim that rebel forces have captured Alamata?
We're hearing the rumors. As you know, it's an area where we can't even travel in. I just came back from Humara and my country, where genocide happened late last year. And that was also believed to have been captured by the TPLF. I was in Humara, and that wasn't true. But when it comes to Alamata and Kore, where the 1984 Ethiopian famine happened, it seems to be, we've been hearing from different credible sources. They're telling us it indeed has been captured by the TPLF. And the leadership of the TPLF was in Alamata, Getachew Reda, meeting with his family, giving us more proof that it has been captured by the TPLF forces, or TDF.
And what will that mean for the people, for the residents who live there?
I mean, when I was in Humara, it seemed to have been a very dead city. It was tense. The people seemed to be confused. And it continues to be that way because, can you imagine living in a city where you don't even know who is in charge? So I think the people of Alamata are going through that kind of process.
Now, what do you make of the prime minister's response that he's going to repel these attacks?
Well, there seems to be a willingness to respond. But again, I have to wonder what it means on the ground with this conflict reaching its first year anniversary in November, with so many people attacked. I have to speak from the humanitarian perspective. It seems to be a very overwhelming conflict that's going to continue to attack more, affect more people, and the famine is going to be certainly in the future of the region.
We spoke just 2 weeks ago, and there was a unilateral ceasefire declared by the federal government. What's happened to that?
So the ceasefire that was to have come into effect was the idea of the Ethiopian government. The TPLF felt it wasn't consulted enough, and they called it a sick joke, quote unquote. And they had their own ideas how they would endorse some kind of ceasefire. And some of the demands they had was the release of all its political prisoners. They felt that they were targeted because of their background, according to them. The recognition of their TPLF government in Mekelle and transfer payment that they felt should go to them, that they deserve to receive from the federal government. So these were some of the demands they had. So I don't think it has been implemented the way it should have been. And according to the UN, there are many, many areas that they can't access and give, everyday people the support they need so the Ethiopia can prevent a famine that's certain to come to the area. And you have to remember, close to 1 million people, according to the Biden administration in Washington, are facing famine. So this is a disaster that we can't help but watch from a distance because nobody can access it anymore.
Samuel Getachew is a freelance journalist in Ethiopia. Samuel, please take care of yourself, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back with you now on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Last week, my little quarantine pod took a good old-fashioned family road trip. After looking at the same four walls for all year, 12 hours in a minivan with kids and dogs managed to feel like freedom. But as we traveled south from North Carolina to New Orleans, stopping for snacks, gas, and stretches along the way, we started to feel like we were the last mask-wearing people in the country. It prompted my youngest, who's 7, to ask at one point, "Mommy, is the coronavirus over now?" I can't tell you how much I wish I could have responded with an enthusiastic, "Yes, don't worry, baby, we're all good." But I'm sorry to report, that isn't the case. In fact, the number of new cases per day in the U.S. has doubled over the past 3 weeks. And the overwhelming majority of these cases are among the unvaccinated. And just to make a point, the unvaccinated are a more diverse group than you might think. It's not just about ideology. It's not just about region. It's not just about race or age. So right now, with this new, more contagious Delta variant that is responsible for more than half of these COVID cases, we are in a real situation. And you've been talking to us about this as well at 877-869-8253.
Hi, this is Susan from Vashon, Washington. The spread of the Delta variant is definitely a warning to me that the pandemic is not over. So I am continuing to mask up in public places, also continuing regular hand washing. However, I cannot resist the opportunity to hug.
I'm not as cautious as I was last year, but I still wear a mask whenever I go into a store or a public place. I wash my hands constantly. I try to keep a social distance, and I rarely eat out anymore. It's sad, but I just don't think we're through the pandemic completely yet. This is Barbara in San Jose.
I feel safe from the Delta variant. I'm vaccinated with the RNA type Moderna vaccine. I still mask up when a business or proprietor wishes it to be polite and respectful, but otherwise, I am mask-free. This is Doug in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from Ridgewood, New Jersey. So yes, it is definitely making me realize how much the pandemic is not over. I continue to wear a mask when I enter a public establishment, regardless of what the regulations say. I also continue to prefer outdoor dining or empty off-hour restaurants. It just seems safer.
Hi, this is Mike Rahimi from the Bronx, New York. I'm not at all concerned with the new Delta variant. I have been fully vaccinated since the early part of March this year. I also had COVID 15 months ago. Everything that I've read said that the mRNA vaccines are 94% effective, preventing me from getting a serious case or hospitalization.
Hi, this is Teresa Goodell from Beaverton, Oregon. Yes, I am still wearing a mask. I'm concerned about the spread of the Delta variant, so I'm sticking with the plan. I'm going to go on wearing a mask in public places, and I'm also limiting contact with people from outside my household and close friends. I know people who are immunocompromised, and I don't want to put them or myself and family at risk.
Yes, my name is Michael, and I am in Buffalo, New York. I'm a physician in a high-volume emergency department, and the Delta variant is causing a spike in COVID among people who are not vaccinated, and it's causing deaths. And it's heartbreaking because people seem to think that the vaccine is experimental or it's not approved or, you know, it's been so politicized that they don't want to get the vaccine until they get sick. And they didn't really believe that they could get sick, but now it's spiking back and they get sick and they get very sick and some of them die. And it's breaking my heart that such a disinformation campaign is costing so many lives. It's very upsetting.
With me now to discuss the rising COVID rates and the Delta variant is Emily Martin, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Okay, so cases are rising in more than half of U.S. states. Can you talk about where the kind of geographic hotspots are?
Absolutely. So we are definitely seeing rises in states like Arkansas is kind of the fastest, the highest state right now, but Tennessee is the fastest climbing. We're seeing a lot of cases in Florida. I think Missouri's really been in the news for high cases and a lot of hospitalizations. Nevada's been in the news, Louisiana. We see a lot of big climbs in southern states particularly as well.
You know, it's when you said Florida, like just in that moment, my knees buckled a little bit because our family was planning our annual August, you know, Florida vacation. And, you know, we have a 7-year-old who cannot be vaccinated yet. And it feels like, man, we're going to have to say again this year, can't do it.
Yeah, this is a big challenge for families of young kids and kids that are too young to be vaccinated. I know, you know, my family, we've got a vacation planned for August with a mix of vaccinated and unvaccinated kids. And, you know, we're going to have to be more careful than I think we were hoping we would have to be.
So talk to me about this vaccinated and unvaccinated. So again, our 7-year-old, that's not an option to be vaccinated yet. So even though the adults in the family are vaccinated, we're, you know, modeling, wearing the masks and washing the hands and all of those things we've been doing for a year and a half. But what do we know about the populations of folks who are unvaccinated?
You know, the national percentage, if you look overall at adults nationwide, we're approaching 70%, which is good news. We need to be higher, but 70% is pretty good. But really, if you break that down, what it looks like is, you know, we've got almost 90% of our 75 and older adults are vaccinated. Over 90% of our 65 to 75 adults are vaccinated. And so it's really, you know, if we get down to the 18-year-olds to the 40-year-olds, so those in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, we're only looking at about half of those adults are vaccinated. And so what we're going to start to see is this concentration of infection in these lower age groups that aren't taking up the vaccine as fast as the older adults. Now, granted, it hasn't been recommended for those adults for as long, right? We prioritize the older adults because they're at higher risk of hospitalization. But, you know, younger adults can still infect children. And so we really need to get the numbers up in those younger groups.
Now, let's talk about Delta for a moment. I was during a family road trip. I had a conversation just briefly with someone at a gas station who said, oh, I was going to get vaccinated, but now that there's the Delta variant, I'm not going to because there's no vaccine against the variant. And I thought, no, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. So help our listeners. If you are vaccinated, are you still at risk relative to Delta?
You know, so the vaccine absolutely works against the Delta variant. There may be small differences in how the vaccine works, but, you know, we are monitoring this really closely in groups all over the world, including, you know, my research group monitors this too. And what we know right now, the vaccine is working against the Delta variant. It does spread faster. There's some data that says that it causes more severe infection. And so, you know, the balance is definitely on the side to still get vaccinated against this variant.
If we don't reach the vaccination levels that we want to, sort of in the general population, will that have an impact on the effectiveness of the vaccine relative to this variant?
It won't have an impact on how the vaccine works in any individual person. It will impact the fact that, you know, the vaccine we think is reducing 80 to 90% of infections. So it leaves about 10 to 20% of infections left behind. That 10 to 20%, it's a much bigger bucket if you've got a community with a lot of transmission. So basically, the more disease you have in the community, the more likely you are to have those rare events where a vaccinated person gets infected. So we need to do both. We need to vaccinate and we need to do what we need to do to get the rates down overall in the community.
So let's talk about young children who, at least as of now, aren't able to have the vaccinations. It seems that at least in some places, we're seeing more cases of children getting not simply in the COVID positive test, but getting severely sick. Am I right? Or is that just that now we're reporting on it more? What's going on with kids?
You know, there's a few things going on. Yes, we're reporting on it more. You know, kids are as the highest rate of unvaccination because they're not even eligible. We've got all these unvaccinated susceptible kids. And so that's where a lot of our infection is happening. And so the more infection we have, the more we see these rare events, which are kids getting hospitalized, kids getting into the intensive care unit, having really heartbreaking outcomes. For the average kid, it's not a very high frequency event, but if you infect enough children, then yes, you're going to start to see these hospitalizations.
So recently in Los Angeles County, there's been a recommendation all residents wear masks in public indoor spaces, vaccinated and unvaccinated. Do you think that other cities and states will follow suit on that?
Yeah, I've watched a lot of organizations and local governments struggle with this question because, you know, it's very difficult to figure out who is vaccinated and who is not vaccinated. And if you're having big increases in your community, you know, that's the scenario where a policymaker may want to make this one-size-fits-all recommendation. Across the board, we have to do something. Let's mask everybody. You know, I know that masking is more controversial, but at the same time, it's low cost. It's not as economically devastating as other measures that people might want to take. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see this in kind of isolated geographic events around the country.
Right. Keep the economy open, but wear a mask, right? Because before we had to all sort of go home, and maybe this could at least keep us out, keep the economy humming. What about schools? So, for example, I guess middle schools and high schools, where most of the young people are of age to be vaccinated, and for college campuses, which seems to fall right in that spot of young adults who you've talked about are less likely to be vaccinated, should they be, and I don't mean this is a political matter, I mean it purely is an epidemiological one, should schools and colleges and universities be requiring vaccination?
Well, if we don't require vaccination, it's very difficult to get from 50% to the 80 to 90% that we need without it. And if we don't get there, then, you know, we don't have that, you know, I know herd immunity is sort of a thought experiment, but we don't have those high levels that we need to be able to slow down transmission. And so the alternative to requiring it means that some schools and colleges are going to be looking at fall-like situations where they may have to take pauses in education. They may have to require masks more than they want to. You know, it's going to be a more complex situation in the fall compared to having high vaccination rates.
Emily Martin is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And if you've been a regular listener during the last month, you've likely heard me confess that my current fashion acumen is well below, I see you made an effort, and only just above, oh girl, no.
Hated it.
Which explains my utterly blank expression when the far more fabulous urbane young producers of The Takeaway came to me with an idea to discuss issues of fashion and racial justice. Who cares about fashion in a pandemic?
A lot of people.
Came the side-eyed response. Turns out they were right. Every day, fashion publications, designers, editors, stylists, models, photographers, tastemakers, and trendsetters make choices that wield significant cultural power. And for too long, these choices have deepened racial inequities. And now there's a movement to wield this influence to advance racial justice. I sat down with Lindsay Peoples-Wagner, editor-in-chief of The Cut from New York Magazine, to discuss what the last year and a half have been like for the fashion industry.
It's just been, I think, really complicated and frustrating and emotional for a lot of people in fashion, because a lot of the things that we have experienced, especially as people of color, have been prevalent for a while, and it hasn't been a secret. But I think this past year definitely has given people the space and the time, and I think just the level of comfortability to be able to speak up a little bit more and raise our concerns. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, people of color, you know, in fashion industry, we want to be seen and heard, and we want that equality. We want that equity. We want to be able to, you know, actually see diversity, not just on the runways, but behind the scenes. And so it's going to take a really long time, as I think racism is really embedded in the fashion industry and privilege in many ways that I think people don't understand. But it's definitely a start in this past year, finally having some really crucial conversations.
All right, so I want you to pick apart and kind of describe for us the various aspects of the fashion industry, right? So for those of us who are not in the industry, who maybe only see one aspect of it, say the, you know, photographs of runway models, but talk to me about the other pieces, the editors, the designers, the presumptions about beauty. You can pick whatever sort of buckets, but help us to understand what aspects of the industry need both diversity and justice change.
So much in fashion and beauty spaces, because I think what people don't realize is the representation and the responsibility that we have directly affects everything, whether it's, you know, from beauty standards, celebrities getting, you know, roles or being a big face of a brand, to, you know, who you look up to and who you idolize and what you think is possible for your own life growing up. And I think what people also fail to understand about what we do in fashion and beauty spaces is a lot more subjective. And so the industry has gotten away with a lot of bad behavior for a very long time. We readily are choosing every single day who's cool, who's worthy of an opportunity, who's on brand, who has the right aesthetic. And all of those decisions are a really huge responsibility. And so I think in my role, it's always been, how can I be intentional and thoughtful with this responsibility, with this power?
So, Lindsay, I'm struck by you saying the part of what you do, particularly as an editor, is to determine what's cool, right? To say, this is what's in, right? This is what's cool. And yet I'm thinking about how much that sort of aesthetic does always feel to me like it emerges from, frankly, from Black women, but also frequently from Asian American women, that sense of like, oh, this is what is beautiful, this is what is hot. But then it gets shifted, right? Maybe even appropriated by the sort of broader fashion industry. What is that relationship like?
Yeah, I mean, appropriation has always been extremely tough because to me, it's very common sense. I mean, if you didn't come up with something, there's no problem in you know, giving credit where it's due. But I think, yeah, I mean, a lot of intellectual property and ideas in fashion, I think, get, you know, twisted. And also, I think that people don't ever really want to do the history and learn. And I think a big thing also in fashion is a lot of the references that we use of, you know, where a hairstyle came from or where a certain fabric came from or where a style of a dress came from. And there just hasn't been enough. There haven't been enough editors who actually want to take the time, and it is required for them to actually learn the history of different people of color and styles and fashions and inventions and creators and innovators in the past. I think a lot of times people assume if there's a trend or something that, oh, like, well, this white designer did it, so they were the person who came up with this. When a lot of times when you do your research and your history, oh, no, that was actually a person of color who created that or started that, and maybe they just weren't as famous or they didn't have as much access. And so it's always been, I think, a contentious relationship, and appropriation has definitely been rampant in the industry. But I think, you know, more and more there, I mean, I'm only one of the few people of color editors in the industry, but I think we're trying to make some strides to make sure that it is a better industry.
I'm wondering if conversations about diversity and inclusion, right, just to use those terms, around, for example, body size or gender self-presentation, or age, right? So for older folk and plus-size folk and folks whose gender self-presentation may not align with cisgender norms, I'm wondering if they're connected such that one kind of justice or inclusion brings the other, or if they really need to be separate conversations within fashion.
I mean, I think they're connected, and I often talk to brands about it all the time. I think also sustainability is connected to that as well. I think, you know, climate change is connected to racial justice. I think size inclusivity is also connected to this conversation. Inclusivity as a whole, I think, you know, the fashion industry hasn't made enough strides. I mean, if you just want to talk about specifically size inclusivity alone, I've been writing about size inclusivity for so long. And there are so many different events, you know, plus size fashion week and different things that are geared towards inclusivity around sizing that editors just do not go to, have never seen, don't care. And I think that to me is also a larger industry change. The industry needs to change, like, what is allowed, what is okay, what are the standards for an editor? Because I think that really also has not shifted traditionally. I mean, if you want to talk about largely in that, you know, what you're also talking about is beauty standards. And most beauty editors wouldn't be able to tell me, like, what my curl pattern hair type is. Because they're, you know,
yeah,
they're
that's not the mystery, really, right?
Yeah. And they're not, because they're versed in European beauty standards and, you know, they know the big name hair brands, all of that, but they wouldn't be able to tell me, okay, I'm taking my braids down today, I have 4C hair, what should I be using to detangle, et cetera. And so I think that standard also in the industry has to change in order to have these conversations, because right now that standard is low. So people don't feel like, okay, you're a fashion editor, you should also be inclusive around size and sustainability and all these other things. And I think once that standard and that bar is raised, it would become a lot more of a natural conversation, because it's very natural to me, but I don't think where we're at is natural to the people in power. So then it doesn't also become part of the conversation.
So see, Lindsay, because you brought it up, I feel like you have to give us an answer to that question. If I'm taking my braids down with my 4C hair, what is the conditioner or detangler I should be using?
I actually just tried from Tracy L. Sauce's line. She has this pattern brush, and then I use this brand Amika, and it has a detangler, and its detangler is actually wonderful. So look that up. Yeah.
See, there you go. News you can use here on The Takeaway. It's like, for real, though, that is where the struggle meets the reality of our daily lives. Lindsay yep. Peoples-Wagner is the editor-in-chief of The Cut. Lindsay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
I'll throw on some Black Lives Matter high heels this weekend. Actually, let's make that some Black Lives Matter flip-flops. I'm not ready for high fashion. But anyway, that's all we have for y'all today. Appreciate you tuning in. And don't worry, we're going to be right back tomorrow. Call us with your ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.